Good morning, and today we will finish the section on abstract data types and then get onto real data structures, namely 2-3 trees and possibly also red-black trees. So this is where we stopped last time. This is the Isabel version of an abstract data type, where the it's called a locale, and the name here is set. And the fixes section introduces the interface, all the functions that you expect the data type to have with their types. And then the assumes clauses, they explain what properties those functions should have. And they were not randomly chosen, but they were the result of a general schema. And and we discussed that briefly. The schema was that for every function, the function f and its abstract version fa should commute with the abstraction function, and then the invariant should be preserved by all the functions. So that's where we stopped last time, and now I want to also show you how to use those ADTs. We don't just specify them for fun, but they have some use, namely that you can now program in the context of an ADT, and which means you can use the functions of the ADT, but you're not committing to any particular implementation. The implementation can later on be chosen, and then you get your generic code runs with whatever implementation you've chosen. And so this is the what I've just said. The purpose of an ADT is to provide some context, namely both the interface and the assumptions on the interface, and you can then implement generic algorithms that use that context, that use that interface, and that gives you parameterized code that can later be specialized with particular implementations. And this is what this looks like in Isabel. In fact, rather than just having the locale with its fixes and assumes, you can actually also add some code into the locale. So in the context of those fixes and assumes, you can then define some functions. Here is a very simple example, the function set of list that takes a list and converts it into a set, and it uses the functions from the interface. So it uses the empty function, which comes from the fixes interface, and it uses the insert function that comes also from that interface, and it just recursively goes down the list and inserts one element after the other. It's not a particularly exciting function, but it just serves as a simple example of how to program in the context of some interface. And so this is generic code that's parameterized with the functions of the interface of the set data type, but you can also perform now proofs about that function. So you can, for example, show that the invariant is preserved by the function set of list. So the set that you get out of this set of list function satisfies the invariant. And this is a proof that is only possible because we don't just have an interface, but we also assume some properties of the interface. And so you'll see in the auto line in that proof, it says use as simplification rules the two properties invar empty and invar insert, which are here in the assume section, so you don't see them, but they are named properties, and I'm using those properties. So those are also generic proofs that are dependent on the assumptions of the abstract data type. So this is a simple example of doing something within the context of an abstract data type, and thus obtaining generic code that can run with any implementation of the data type. So how do we implement abstract data types? Well, the idea is quite simple. You have to give code for all the functions in the interface, and you have to prove that that code satisfies all the properties in the assume section. And this is how it's, so this is what I just said. You implement the interface and you prove the specification in the assumes section. And now we showed a concrete example of that. Here in the example, we are using the data type of trees to implement our set data type, our abstract set data type, and we have to define functions isIn and insert on the tree type. I'm writing them in, printing them in blue, because now we're in the situation where it's a little bit confusing. We have chosen to call the concrete functions on the tree type the same as the abstract functions. And so in order not to confuse, I've given the concrete ones the blue color and the abstract ones will remain black. Now, after you've done that, now you have implemented the interface, and now you need to tell the system that you have performed this this implementation. And this is how it's done in Isabel. There's a command called interpretation. Why is it called interpretation? Because you interpret the interface. You interpret all of the functions in the interface. How are they realized? And this is how it looks like concretely. So you say, please interpret the set interface as follows. Empty is just leaf. So we're making an interpretation on the left of the function in the interface called empty, and on the right, the corresponding function in the concrete implementation. And here we just implement the empty set by the leaf constructor. And then isIn and insert are the confusing ones because both names are the same. We could have chosen a different name, and maybe I should do that next time. But here I chose a different color. So the isIn function on the left is the one in the interface, and it's equated with your concrete implementation on the tree data type. And similarly for insert, and then the next ones are again unambiguous. The set function was the abstraction function. That's what we call the abstraction function in the interface. If we go back a couple of slides, we'll see that. In our interface here, set was the function that mapped our implementation type of sets back to the abstract sets, and invar was the invariant in the fixes section there. And now we're also interpreting those functions. And set is just the set tree function that comes with the concrete tree data type, and invar is the binary search tree invariant that we defined a long time ago already. So that's the first half here. We have implemented the interface, all the interface functions. We have interpreted them with concrete code, but that's not enough. We also need to prove that the properties required by the assumes section in the set specification are satisfied, and so that interpretation has to be followed by a proof. And the proof will explicitly have to prove all of the properties. So here I'm writing them down again. Show set tree of empties, the empty list, the empty set. We have to show that set tree of insert tree is the same as set tree of the original tree union, that element X that we have inserted, and so on. And in each case, we of course, well, not in each case, in this case, this will have to be for an arbitrary but fixed set S, and it has to satisfy the binary search tree invariant, and so on. So essentially, for each of the assumes statements here, you have a corresponding proof. And instead of writing, I prove this double arrow, it's like the second in the second assumes line, invar of S, double arrow something, I already assumed this on the left-hand side, and I proved this on the right-hand side. So that's why it doesn't look identically to what's there, because I've just written it down in a more economic fashion, assuming the BST, because now, of course, I don't assume invar, I'm assuming the corresponding implementation here, the binary search tree thing. And similarly, I'm not using the abstract function set, but I'm using the concrete function set tree that maps a tree to a set, and so on. Yep.
Where is the function insert tree?
That was defined on, good question. I think I made a mistake here. These two slides don't quite fit together. I think what I've called insert in blue here is insert tree here. So in fact, and so there's a mismatch. Even that blue one is the same as that one. I should decide whether I want to make it in blue without the tree or in black with the tree. I think the better readable one is if I everywhere change the blue insert for the insert tree here.
Okay, so the show statement, all of the functions come from the tree data.
Yes. So we're showing for the concrete implementation type that it satisfies the abstract laws when you translate all the names to the concrete level. And thank you for pointing out that error. Because this is not really the actual Isabel code. This is handcrafted on the slide by typing it in, and then problems arise. Whereas much of the code that you usually see is really directly printed automatically from the Isabel sources into the slide, and then no more mistakes can arise. But here it was a bit of a mixture. Any other questions? So what is the result of that? So as a first result, of course, when the proof goes through, you have the moral satisfaction. You know you have proved all the laws of the all the requirements of the set data type. On the other hand, you get more because the set interface is not the original one, but it's the enriched one. So this set, in fact, is supposed to refer to this one, which is enriched by this code here and by the proof there. So what you get out in the end is not just, yes, it's okay, but what you get out is also a function set of lists that now takes you from a list into a tree. So this is the specialized version that operates on the trees as a set data type, and you get the theorem that for this specific function, the BST invariant is true. So you get specialized versions of the theorems. So this interpretation command is like also a function and a theorem generator. It generates you as specialized versions of the functions in there, and it generates you specialized versions of the theorems in there for the particular interpretation of the names in the interface that you have given. So all these theorems, well, that one theorem now no longer refers to the abstract functions, but it refers very concretely to the functions on trees. So any last questions about this methodological section on abstract data types and implementation? If not, then let's get on with the subject proper, the search trees. And I want to start with 2-3 trees, and then probably today also connect them with red-black trees, because I think that's the best way to actually introduce red-black trees. So what are 2-3 trees? This is just a reference into the sources that you can take a look at if you want to. And now here are the important parts. A 2-3 tree is simply a data type that has now three constructors, the empty tree as usual, now something I'll call node 2, which is the binary node with two subtrees, but there's also a node 3, which is a ternary node that has three subtrees. And of course, the idea is that in the subtree on the left, you have the smallest elements, then all smaller than the element that comes next to it, and then come the elements that are larger than that element but smaller than the next element, and finally come all the elements in the last search tree that are bigger than all everything before here. And the notation is like before. If I use the angular brackets with three arguments, it's a two node, and if I use the angular brackets like that, then it's a three node. So that's the concrete representation, and the isIn function, of course, is perfectly simple. This is the isIn function. Well, how it operates on a leaf node and on a two node is like before, and on a three node, you will now compare the element x that you're searching first. Well, that's one way of doing it. You first compare it with A, the left of the two elements in the node, and if it's less then you have to search in the left subtree. If it's equal, it's true. Otherwise, you have to compare it with B, and if it's less then it's in the middle tree. Oh, if it's there at all, it's in the middle tree, and if it's equal, it's true, and if it's greater, then you search the right subtree. So that's just the interpretation that I already explained to you. Of course, we're assuming here some search tree invariant, that the elements are really, if you take their in-order traversal, that list is really ordered. Oops. Yeah. And I'm not spelling that invariant out here. As I said before, the search tree invariant, that things are ordered in the right manner, that can all be done automatically and is really not worth discussing here. And almost all algorithm textbooks sort of just assume that it's obvious that this works. Right, now the interesting one is the structural invariant. And this is kind of surprising, at least when I came to the 2-3 trees for the first time, it did surprise me that in contrast to things like AVL trees and red-black trees, where you have some approximate balancing, which is off by a factor that you can afford, here you really have a perfectly balanced one. All leaves are at the same level in a 2-3 tree. Therefore, the balancing means the leaf is, of course, balanced. A two-leaf is balanced if both are balanced and their height is the same. And similarly, for a three-leaf, all subtrees must be balanced and their height must be the same, all three heights. So, of course, we'll have to see that this can really be achieved. And then you get a lower bound for the size and height relationship. So the worst thing that can happen to you if you want to compare size and height is that you only have two nodes in your tree, but then it's perfectly balanced, and therefore you know the relationship already, that the 2 to the height is a lower bound for the size of the tree. And of course, you also have a corresponding upper bound, where the best thing you can achieve is if you have lots of three nodes, or all only three nodes. And now let's discuss insertion. So how does insertion work here? If you have a leaf, you make it into a two node. If you have a two node, you make it into a three node. But what if you want to insert into a three node? Well, then you have an overflow. You can't make it into a four node. And so that means you have to pass one element back up. In order to formalize that, we introduce a new data type that has two possible values. It tells you, well, this insertion, everything is fine, the height did not change, or, oops, I'm sorry, the insertion caused this tree to overflow and the height has increased by one. And this is the the T is the constructor that tells you everything went fine, and the tree that I'm returning has the same height as the original tree. And it's got a little I as a subscript because we will have the same consideration, not just for insertion, we're talking about insertion here, but also for deletion where an underflow can occur. And so we will have two data types that are the return values of the insert and of the delete function. So here we're talking about the insertion. So TI means everything went fine. I will just say T, and the I is just a differentiating subscript to remind us that we're talking about the insert case. And on the other hand, if you have an overflow, then what you return is an up with three arguments, L left subtree, an element, and a right subtree. So I haven't composed those into a tree because that wouldn't, we need the property that what we're returning is not an arbitrary tree, but it's really a pair of two subtrees and an element. And therefore, I haven't baked them together already like I did for the capital T return value. And this is the data type. Either it's a tree or it's a pair of two trees and an element. So this is what insertion is going to return. And in the end, when we've percolated everything up to the top level, then we want to translate it back into a normal tree. And so we want a function that translates from this new data type up. So this is the name of the data type up, I for insertion, back into a normal tree, a 2-3 tree. And the function is quite straightforward. If it's just a normal tree, then you just unwrap the constructor capital T. And if it's something that is an overflow, well, at the very top, you don't care anymore. If it's an overflow, you just combine it into a normal two node. Right. So now we need to look at insert. How do we insert an element into such a tree? And well, it's done with the help of an ins function, which does all the work. And afterwards, so ins really goes through the tree and then comes back up and adjusts things. And in the end, we want a 2-3 tree out of the insert function, but the ins function will only give us an up element. So this is the type of the ins function. It gives us one of these intermediate data types, and the tree function is applied to it to really pull out the actual tree as defined on the previous slide at the bottom. And some of the clauses are quite obvious. If you want to insert into an empty tree, well, that is an overflow, and so you pass back this triple empty tree, element empty tree, and let the higher levels deal with that. If you insert into a binary node, that's unproblematic because this is the code. Well, actually, let's look at the code. Let's construct the code by hand. I think it's sufficient. It's unproblematic, but it's still interesting to get the hang of what's going on. So we want to insert X into that tree, and so of course we first have to compare the X and the A. So case compare X A of, and then we will just look at one branch, the other either obvious or symmetric. So if X is less than A, then of course we have to insert it into the left subtree, but then the left subtree might overflow and we'll have to deal with that. So then we analyze the result of that. Case ins of x in the left subtree of. And then we have two possible outcomes. One is the nice outcome, nothing overflowed, you just get a tree out. And then, of course, we could even call that L prime to emphasize the relationship. Then, of course, you can just substitute the L prime back for in for the L, and you return L prime A and R. Almost, you still have to wrap it up in this T constructed the signal that no overflow occurred. So the more interesting part is if you have an up here, let's call it L1, and I call it here B and L2. So we have an overflow in the left subtree, which means that the L1 and L2 are of the same height as R. Yes. Well, R is up there, yes. So what would it make sense to pass up back up now? We are in a two node, but we also have three nodes. Yeah, yeah. So it's the three node. Of, well, of course, the L has now expanded into an L1, B, L2, and the rest, the A and the R, are maintained. And so this makes sense because, you know, the overflow means that the tree that you returned here, the two subtrees here, have the same height as the original tree, and therefore, sorry, as the original tree, which is the L, and therefore the same height as R, and so it's perfectly okay to have them all at the same level. So that's the informal reasoning that's working on here, and that's it. The rest of the cases are symmetric. So insertion into a two node isn't too onerous. Therefore, let's look at insertion into a three node. So what do we do now? Basically, we start like this. So let me just wipe this off so I don't, well, no, wiping off just is a mess usually. So we have comparison com x a off, and then we have a less than branch, and then we're actually okay. Of course, if it's greater than, then we have to compare with b as well, and but then it's the same thing again once we descend into one of the subtrees. So let's assume we're lucky and we only look at the case where really the x is less than the a. So then we do as there. We analyze what happens, what is returned from the insertion into the subtree. And again, if nothing overflowed, then we can just rebuild that subtree, and now it's a three subtree, so it's an L prime A M B R and a T in front of it. And the interesting one is the up of L1, what I call that here, C L2. What do we do now? We have to return, yeah, can we balance things out locally, or is it going to be an overflow to the next level? That's exactly it. We return that as the we say it's an overflow, but what are the two subtrees? One is this one, L1 C2. Then the A is in the middle, and then the second subtree, that's an argument of the up, will be the rest here, the NBR. So it's possible that you could do some other combination, and maybe if you're a genius, you can even manage to avoid an overflow, but no, you can't if you go through all the possibilities. This is really essentially the only thing that works, but the fact that it works is already sufficient. We don't have to prove that this is the only possibility. And so why does it work? Well, again, the informal reasoning is what you get here out of an overflow means that the L1 and the L2 are actually of the same height as the original L, and therefore they are at the same level as the M and the R. And so this makes, again, from a balancing point of view here makes sense. All of the trees here are at the same level, and here they're at the same level. And so you can put them, and they're all four subtrees are at the same level. So it makes sense to put them together as a binary tree like that. Of course, they're not yet a binary tree because we still have to pass them further up. But morally, you can think of this as a binary node with these two subtrees and that one in the middle. So yes, that wasn't too bad. And this is, of course, the full set of cases. In fact, it's not the full set, it's continuing down there at the end of the slide, but here what you see is the essence. All the other ones are completely dual, and so I'm not going to go through them. And this is what typically gives the 2-3 trees a bad name, because people say, oh, there are so many cases and you can have much more compact code, but I find them actually quite intuitive what's going on here, so I'm a big fan of 2-3 trees. Right, so now, do they really do what we expect them to do? Does the insertion function really do what we expect it to do? And this is what we want to have at the what the behavior of the ins function should be, that if the original tree is balanced and you insert an element A into it, and then you extract the tree from that, which gets rid of the T constructor and the up constructor, then that should again be a balanced tree. So let's just try and prove that by induction, of course, on T. Well, it's simply an induction on T because the balance function, the insert function that we're proving things about, is just by primitive recursion. You always go from a tree to one of the subtrees. So that essentially means structural induction is perfectly adequate. Of course, you can also say it's computation induction on the computation of the ins function. That's also correct. And I just want to go through this proof, and then we will figure out what's missing, because we will find the proof doesn't go through, and then we'll have to strengthen the lemma. And so this is just an exercise in coming up with a strengthened lemma. So we do an induction on T, and let's go directly to some of the sub-cases. The case that T is nil is not interesting, so we assume, let's write, we go into the case that we have a proper node, and we go into the sub-case that the A that we're inserting is actually less than the X, so that the comparison of A and X is less than. And finally, we also look at the case, what happened, because we have another case distinction. If you go back to the code, this is the insertion into a two node. And so we have made the decision, we look at the two node, we look at the comparison less than case, and here we also look at the first case of the two, not the up case, but the T case. So another subcase here is that the call insert A in L gives you back a tree. It's called the L prime. Yeah, there we are. And now let's try and prove that what we get out of this is again balanced. So we know the input tree was balanced. The input tree is this one, so we can assume that L and R are balanced. And we can assume that the height of left and right is the same. What do we need to show? We need to show balance of tree of insert, well, let's just write it out, insert A L, insert A T, sorry. And we are in the situation that the insert L gives us this, and therefore the code will return tree of T of L prime X R. That's where we are. And now we can eval. So this is just by that subcase gives us this step. And now we can compute what tree of this thing is, namely that's just, oh sorry, yeah, tree of that one is just the thing inside the T, and so we have to show balance of this thing. And that's of course the same as balance of L prime and balance of R and height of L prime equals height of R. Now, balance of R was one of our assumptions. That's okay. Where does balance of L prime come from? But why can we assume that? No, it's because we're doing induction. And so the induction says if you insert into the subtree, then the induction hypothesis is that works well. So this is the induction hypothesis. But where does that come from? And it doesn't come from anywhere, we don't have it. Because that's, we're proving something about the balancedness, but in that proof, we need something about the height, and we haven't proved anything about the height. And so we need to strengthen what we're proving. And so in order to prove something about the height, well, this L prime is something that was inside this T constructor. So really, we want to know something about the height of the thing that the insert function returns, but the thing that the insert function returns is one of these auxiliary data structures, a t or an up. So we need to define a height function just to make things, to express things properly. We need a height function that goes from this intermediate data type up into the natural numbers. And the definition, so I'm giving it the same name as the standard height function, but it's now it operates on this extra data type. And this is the definition. And the first line of the definition isn't too surprising if that element is a proper tree. Well, you just take the height of the tree. Now, the second one may be a bit confusing because so far we have thought of this up construct just as a different way of saying, well, this is a binary tree, LAR, but it's overflowed. So then you might expect the height of that to be equal to the height of the left or the height of the right plus one, but here we're just saying it's the same as the height. The reason for that will become, hopefully become clear in a moment, because now we want to use this function and we want to say that if the original tree T is balanced, then we also know something about the height of the output, the height of the result of this ins of AT. And this is what will work. So we say that the height of insert A T is the same as the height of T. That sounds contradictory because we just said, well, sometimes it can overflow and therefore the height is not the same. But writing it like this works well together with this definition here, the second line in the H definition, where we have intentionally not said plus one. We can now use the fact that if it overflows, we are still returning the old height. And so in a sense, you can think of the height function on this up data type as saying, what is the old height? And the old height of a T is just the height of the of T, because then it's a non-overflow. And if you have an up thing, then the old height of, is not the height of L plus one, but it's just the height of L. And therefore, this is the, at least it's a working definition. I'm not claiming that you can't do it differently, but this is internally consistent. And you, in order to think about it intentionally, intuitively in the right manner, this new height function should not be thought of as the height of the new tree that's returned, but sort of the height of the old tree. And in that case, that is just by, you can relate it to the L subtree. Right, and with that, if you have that additional definition, then the proof, this proof will actually go through automatically. I don't want to go through it. It's a simple continuation of that one, and you just, the base step and the base and step cases, because they have two cases actually, two and three nodes go through automatically. So this is a typical example of a place where you have to be a bit creative and have to come up with this additional function and give it the right definition and then strengthen your theorem to prove not just something about the balancedness of the result, but also something about the height of the result. And so now you can relate the height of the previous tree to the height of the new tree. And now, as a corollary, once you've proved that, you get, of course, that the new tree that you get out of the insert function. Remember, the insert function here was defined like this. It used the auxiliary ins function and then the tree function that got rid of the up and t constructors. So this is a direct consequence because insert is just defined like this, like tree of ins. So how does deletion go? In some sense, dually. If you have a three node and you delete an element from it, you can turn it into a two node. If you have a two node, well, then if you want to delete the root element, then of course you have an underflow, and then the height decreases by one. And how do you deal with that? If you then pass this underflow up, you try to merge it with some of the siblings on the way to take the place of that lost element. That's the idea. Unless, and of course, in the end, you may pass it all the way up, and then the tree has shrunk in height by one, but that's not a problem. And similarly to the insert situation where we had the normal return value and the overflow value, here we have the normal value and the underflow value, and the t with a subscript d means height is unchanged, and t with a up with a subscript d means you're passing some problem up, and the problem is that the height has decreased by one. And so this is the data type. Here we don't need to distinguish in the up case between the structure of the tree that we're returning. We're just saying we're returning a tree that has shrunk in height, and please do something about it. And then the tree function that gives us back the unmarked tree is just the identity. So how does deletion work? Well, if you delete, you do the same thing as before. You call an auxiliary function called del that does all the work, and then it gives you this up value, and then you have to project that into a normal tree. And so this is what del does: takes an element, a 2-3 tree, and then one of these intermediate data structures. Of course, if you delete something from the empty tree, no underflow occurs, just remains the empty tree, and you can pass it back as an okay element. If you delete something from a singleton tree, and it happens you delete exactly that node, then you have to pass back the empty tree, but with a marker saying, oops, there an underflow occurred, and you have to do something further up. Or if X is distinct from A, then of course the tree is unchanged and you just return the same tree. Similarly, if it's a three node with two elements, with all of them being leaves, so that's just similar to the one before. And so those were the base cases. This is the interesting case. You delete an element from a two node, and now you have to compare the element with the element that you're deleting, the x, with what's in the node. And in the less than case, what you do is you just recurse, but then you call an auxiliary function that rebuilds the tree. So we are, instead of having a locally a big case, I have just defined a new function to perform that. And so the node 2-1 function is supposed to do what? It's supposed to create a two node. It's supposed to take two nodes and an element in the middle and build them together. And the second number, the one, indicates that in the first node we don't actually have a node there, but we have one of these up or t elements. So the first argument is the one that needs to be dealt with. The second one is the unchanged original tree. And so now we should think about how to define that function. So we have two the two arguments, the left and the right argument, can differ in two dimensions. Here we have the dimension that it can be a T, that's an A, and then here we have the question, is it a two node, a three node, or is it a leaf node? Actually, can it be a leaf node here? No, it can't be, because we have already dealt with the leaf nodes. Here we're dealing with leaf nodes, and so when we come to the next clauses, the next equations for del, we know that R is not going to be a leaf, and therefore it has to be a two node or a three node. So let's first take the two node. Oh, right. I'm too complicated. In this case, we don't have to make much of a distinction. We can just call this, say, R. And can then return what? So we just have to look at the first line here, the LT line, the less than line. That's where the node 2,1 is used. And we know from the del function, one of these stochastic values came back. So the next ones are the interesting ones. And here we have to make the case distinctions. So we had an underflow. The tree T is one smaller than the original tree was, so it's it is now at the level of R1 and R2. Well, you can build this three node. That is a balanced three node, but what do you return? Do you return an up or a T? Has it shrunk in height from the original tree LAR, or has it maintained the same height? No, the L is the one where we deleted something, so the T here has a smaller height than L. And if we now build a node with a T in it instead of an L, it'll have a smaller height. And the same with the R, because the R, we now decompose the R into R1 and R2, so that means they have a height less than the R. So that's perfectly okay to fit them all together, but all of them are one level below. The L and the R, and the L and the R were only components of the original tree. So the height is really this. If the original tree had height H, then L and R had height H minus 1, and these have height H minus 2. And so here you now are building a node with the subtrees h minus 1, so the height of this tree is h, sorry, these are all h minus 2, so the whole has h minus 1, and therefore it has one less than the original tree L, A, R that we have on the top line there. So it really needs to be passed up that information that we still we're still in an underflow situation. And now the last case is we have a 3 node here, called R1, B, R2, C, R3. And now we can do what I described on the slide. We try to compensate for the lost height by using merging with siblings here. And this is a sibling of what we had originally here, and therefore there's a possibility of combining them and getting to a tree of the original height, getting back to a tree of the original height. So what would that look like? So I'm claiming you can combine this, so you can just return a normal node, but how do you compose that properly from what you've got? So everything here is the same. What's that one?
The rest
is this bit here, the R2. And if you now go through the different cases, you will find that the height works out well, because the height has, if the original node had height h, then we know this one has height h minus 1. All of these, this has also height h minus 1, so these have all height h minus 2. So h minus 2 put together gets you h minus 1, and again in a node gets you one of height h. So you're perfectly balanced again, and similarly here on that side. That was a very quick and rough estimate that things would work out. Yeah. That, I think, is more or less what we just saw. And the other cases are analogous. In the middle, I have to discuss the middle case. The EQ, if you're in the situation that you want to delete the actual element from the node, then you perform it. You do that like with previous binary search trees. You take the minimal element of the right subtree, and so they call this delmin function that gives you back a pair A prime T, and so A prime is that minimal element that will replace the original A, and the T is the result of the delmin function. So what can have happened is the delmin function can also encounter an underflow because it removes an element, and so the T that's returned from the delmin function is also one of these up T constructs, and so therefore we can now call the node2 function, which says I'm trying to combine two nodes, and the second one is in this up class, that's a symmetric one, a symmetric function, the node2. So just to cover the last open case there. And it turns out that the proof itself is fairly laborious, but it's not difficult. So you really have 13 lemmas. You may be able to combine some of them, but here I have 13 simple lemmas about the how the height changes, how the balanceness changes, and when you put them all together, you finally get the fact that the if you have a balanced tree, then if you call the del function and then look at the tree that's coming back out, it's again balanced. So this is an example of some of a, in the end, fairly simple if somewhat lengthy proof. But here you don't even need an additional height function and any creativity. Basically, when you see, oh, the proof doesn't go through, it's easy to speculate what additional lemma you need. Now, 2-3 trees are not the end of the story. So you can, of course, go on. And in particular, 2-3-4 trees you can build. And we will refer to them in a moment. We're not going through the code. Of course, the code is pretty similar to what we've seen, except many more cases. So you get more combinations, and it just gets a bit overwhelming. But a priori, there's nothing new there. And then there's a general case of B trees invented by Professor Bayer, who used to be in the department for many years until 5 or 8 years ago, and then also A B trees. And I'm sure you've come across B trees before in a database course or even in an efficient algorithms course. We're not doing either of these, and the reason is that they are not so easy to handle in a functional setting, because there each node is typically an array and you're updating that array, and so you're actually getting into an imperative. It's very imperative flavored, that data structure. And if you want to turn that into a functional data structure, it's not well suited to that. It can be done. What you would then do is you would not represent it as an array, each node, but we would represent it as a tree again, as a small whatever binary or whatever search tree in each node, and then you can deal with it functionally well again. It's not that arrays are impossible to deal with functionally, it's just if you then want to reason about that, so for Haskell, for example, has arrays, as does OCaml, but if you want to reason about such functions, then essentially you're getting all the baggage of side effects. You have to deal with that, and the nice algebraic reasoning that we can follow here goes out of the window and things become more complicated. So now I want to move on to red-black trees, and it's not that I don't expect you to have ever seen them before, but I think the change in perspective to a functional one is an interesting one, and also I want to introduce them in a particular way, that they don't just come out of nowhere, but that they are clearly motivated, and you can find all of that in the Hall distribution. And the idea is that you encode 2-3-4 trees as binary trees, and that's really how the red-black trees were originally, how people thought of them. And you use color to express the grouping, which nodes belong together. Because now you only have binary nodes, so in order to express a 2-node, in order to express a 3-node or a 4-node, you have to build that out of a group of 2 nodes, and the color will help us to express which ones belong together. And so this is the idea. On the left-hand side, we have the 2-3-4 tree. On the right-hand side, we have the red-black tree. And so, of course, a leaf on both sides is the same, and a 2-node on both sides is also the same. But what do we do with a 3-node on the 2-3-4 side? Well, that corresponds to a nested 2-node, where the T1, AT2 is just a sub-node of the bigger node with B and T3. And here we're using the color to encode the fact that the this is a subnode. So that node would be colored red, whereas the overall node would be colored black. Of course, you could also encode it like that. You could also encode this three group by shifting the brackets. So that's not there's no unique encoding. And finally, the four node, well, that's again a nested two node, but with now two nodes nested inside each other, and the lower ones are both red. So I assume that is a pretty intuitive motivation. And yeah, red always means I am part of a bigger node. And now the invariants that come with red-black trees are no longer magical, but they are almost forced upon you. And that's what I will discuss on the next slide. So all our red-black trees should be thought of as encodings of 2-3-4 trees in this fashion, and then the invariant comes from the encoding. So there are four different invariants. The first one is the color of the root node. Well, if you go back to that picture, all the root nodes were black. So yes, the root node is black because it's not part of another node, it's just the node itself. Now, by convention, in order to make the invariant easy to express, we consider all the leaf nodes black. So that's a convention, but it helps us to simplify matters. And now, if a node is red, what should the invariant dictate? What would you say? Right. Alternatively, you could also say the parent should be black. Why is it better to say the children should be black? Better in the sense that it's more easier for us in our setting. Because if you want to define this as a recursive function, in the imperative setting, you're thinking about maybe back pointers, but here, if you talk about a node and then relate it to its subnodes, it's much easier than to relate it back to its parent node. And so that's why we've chosen that version of the invariant. And here's something about, all paths from the node to a leaf have the same number of what? Yes, because we are coming from perfectly balanced 2-3-4 trees, and on that level, every path from a node to a leaf has the same number of nodes, but now some of the nodes have been split up, but in splitting those nodes up, you haven't created new black nodes, you've just created subsidiary red nodes, and therefore the number of black nodes is the same on all paths from a node to a leaf. And I think that's all of them. And now from the informal requirement to the formal one, so we introduce a data type of colors, red and black, and then a red-black tree is just a slightly modified binary tree where in the node we additionally have a color field in addition to the usual subtree and elements ones. So the type that I'm defining here is RBT for red-black tree. And as usual, this is the leaf. And now, if I write such a four-tuple, then it'll be short for node, but frequently, actually, we will want nodes with particular color. So if I write capital R with LAR, that stands for a red node with those subtrees L and R. And if I write B, that stands for a black node with those subtrees. Now we want to either force the color of a node or query the color of a node. So there's a color function that goes from a tree to its color, the color of the top node. So here the leaf, by definition, we have set it to be black, and the color of a node is just the color that's stored in the node. And then there's a paint function that takes the color and tree and paints that tree, paints the top node to have that color. And so, well, you can't paint a leaf, that's by definition black, and we won't need to paint leaves, but here, if you paint an arbitrary node, you just, the color field becomes that field that you're giving it. Now we need to discuss the invariants. We have the informal ones, here are the formal ones, and the red-black tree invariant consists of three parts. The first one is that the color invariant holds, the second one is that the height invariant holds, and the third one is that the root node has the color black. And so the height invariant is the one that all paths from the root node to a leaf have the same number of black nodes on it. And the color invariant, that's this one that tells you that if you have a red node, then the subtrees must be black. And so this is, we start with that one, the color invariant. And yeah, it's recursively defined, and you just have to, all the nodes have to satisfy it. And if you're looking at a node with color C, and that color C is red, well, then the color of the two subtrees, L and R, must be black. That's exactly what we had textually. In fact, now comes the moment where I wonder why we have only three invariants, C, H, and the color, whereas we used to have four dots. Oh, right, yeah. Every leaf is considered black, and that's, of course, encoded in the definition of the color function, so we don't need to state it as an invariant. This is the other three is what we need to state explicitly. Then the height invariant, well, the number of black nodes from that node to any leaf must be identical. And in order to encode that, well, we just go recursively down the tree. And then at every node, we don't just require that all the subnodes satisfy the invariant, but also that the black height of the left is equal to the black height of the right subtree. So we introduce a new function, BH, for black height, and that's just the number of black nodes from that node, from the root of that node down to any leaf. And so in reality, in the source file, it's called black height, but for compactness, I've just called BH in the text here. So here I'm just reminding you of the proper name, and otherwise I'm using the other name. So the black height of a leaf is just zero. The black height of a... apparently we're not considering leaves to have the black height. Oh, we could have one. It doesn't matter. We could give that the black height one, because all we're concerned is that the black heights are the same, and whether we start from zero or one doesn't make any difference. Just, I like to start from zero, that's why I've given it the leaf node, the black height zero. And if you have a term, if you have a node with a certain color, if the color is black, then the black height of that node is the black height of the left subtree plus one, and otherwise it's just the black height itself. So if the leaf, if that node is red, then the black height of that node is the same as the black height of the left subtree. this may not be immediately apparent that this is precisely the right definition. Why is there maybe some uneasiness? The uneasiness is in the definition of black height, because with black height, we've arbitrarily chosen the number of black the number of black nodes on the leftmost spine. And why that one? Why shouldn't we have chosen something else, or shouldn't we have required that they're all the same? Well, the fact that they're all the same, that is part of the invariant. And therefore, if we require the invariant, then we can, when we compute the black height, we can actually just compute the black height of the leftmost spine of that subtree. That may not be completely apparent, but at least it's I think somewhat intuitive. Oops. That's it. So I want to close today with just not defining any functions on it, but just defining, proving that the invariant by itself guarantees that the height of the tree is logarithmic in the size of the tree with a factor of 2. So that means in the worst case, it could be twice as deep the tree as the perfectly balanced binary search tree. But in practice, it won't be quite as dramatic as that. This is a worst case. And the perfectly balanced binary search tree is anyway too expensive to maintain. The wrong one. Here we are. So this is the theorem that we want, and we will compose it from 2 lemmas, and I will give you one of the 2, and maybe you can come up with the other one. Let me think about which one I need to provide. So that's one of the 2 lemmas that the I've now phrased it not logarithmically but exponentially, because it's typically easier to prove you avoid real numbers. If you take the black height and 2 to the black height is a lower bound for the size of the tree, or if you take the logarithms, then the black height is just bounded by the logarithm of the size of the trees. And we have seen something like that before, namely when we talked about uncolored binary trees, and there we also had a relationship between some kind of height as a lower bound of the size. Can you remember what that was? So that was, that's of course that was a relation between the minimal height of the tree. 2 to the minimal height was a lower bound for the size. And in essence, the black height is nothing but the minimal height when you forget about the colors. And so that's why this lemma also holds. You could, in fact, derive it from the minimal height lemma by if you have a lemma where it says minimal height here rather than black height, and then show separately that the black height is the same as the minimal height. Okay, so that's one. Now, I also want to have a relationship between the height and the black height of a redneck tree. Any suggestions? Yep.
Black height less than or equal to
height. Black height less than or equal to height. Yes, that's certainly true, but we can do better than that. And in fact, I'm interested in the other relation. Yeah. Yes. Height of a red black tree is less or equal two times black height. So again, if it's a red black tree, why is that the case? Do you want to explain it?
Yeah, because every black tree has to have a black parent and black children, so only in every second round can get black tree.
Yeah. So in the worst case, if you have lots of red levels, then the height of the tree must be two times the
black height.
If there are all these red ones in. But that's the most you can differ between height and black height. And now I think we should be in a good shape. So now from that follows this lemma. And why is that? Well, let's start with 2 to the height of t. So let's just take the exponent there. And I thought I could now, let me modify it. I think this works slightly more easily. Should work as well here. So 2. Oh yeah, you can do that. It works. So now if we use this inequality, so this was lemma 1, and if we use lemma 2 now, what do we get as an upper bound there? No, but almost. Because that doesn't work. So here we have this is less than this, but here we have this with the 2 in the exponent.
Isn't it that squared?
Yeah. Because this is just 2 to the black height squared. And so you need to also transfer the square. And then, of course, you can again take logarithms and you get height of t here. And here you get 2 times log. Size of t.
Right.
There's one tricky bit I want to point out, and these lemmas are both correct, but you won't be able to prove them directly as I've written them down.
Why not?
let's go back to the definition of red black tree. There it is. Now, the natural thing to do here is to prove it by induction on the tree T. But what's the problem if you do that proof? Then you run into a technical problem with that definition of RBT. Yeah.
The problem be that do induction on red nodes.
Yeah, so there may be many ways to solve this. So the problem is that the property is not inductive. If you have a red black tree, its subtrees won't be red black trees because they won't satisfy the color invariant. And therefore, the proof here, you should really use just the parts that are inductive, namely invariant height of T and invariant color of T, and similarly here. But then you run into a problem that, as stated, this lemma isn't quite true anymore. If you drop the color requirement, then you're off by one, and because you don't start with a black color anymore, and then you have to fiddle with the precise statement here, make a case distinction. Oh, if you're red, then I have to add one or subtract one or whatever. So it gets a little bit fiddly. So these red black trees have this slightly annoying property that if you treat them formally, many of the inductions don't go through as planned, but you have to do things slightly more generally, where you don't assume that your tree node, the root node, is black. And if you don't assume that, then you have to change the statement a little bit. So although the code turns out to be quite simple, the proofs are not really simpler than those about the 2-3 trees. So that's just an experience that you have if you want to not just program them, but also prove them. And that really nicely brings me to the end. And next time we will look at the insertion and division functions. Thank you for coming today.